Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 59 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month, we have an interview with US legendary author Karen Callmaker, and you're not going to want to miss it. It's coming up very shortly. But first, let's see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as finding out what's going on in the world of lesfic and what's going on in the world of me. First up, the Amazon charts. Topping the charts in the US as I record this on April the 10th is, well, me. And this is, I have to say, honestly amazing to me as I launched my latest novel, Before You Say I Do, around 5 weeks ago, and it's been on the top of the charts more or less ever since. So I am really, really humbled by it and thrilled, actually, that this book is connecting with so many readers. Of all the comments I've received about it, and the book now has over 200 reviews worldwide, so thank you so much if you penned one. That's just amazing. My favourite reviews, though, are the ones that say that they couldn't put the book down, because that's what I always strive for in my writing. So if you haven't read it yet, my novel asks the question, what happens if you fall for your bridesmaid? Jordan is a professional bridesmaid hired by groom Marcus to help out his future bride Abby, who's stressing out over the wedding. The only problem is, when Abby meets Jordan, she can hardly breathe. Marcus is oblivious. The wedding is weeks away. Will Abby make it to the altar? Oh my god, the tension is unbelievable. I don't know. I just wrote it. Also doing well in the US charts is MJ Duncan with her book Unadulterated Something. Now, this one is the story of rival ice hockey players who end up working together and playing on the same team. Can they get over their animosity and distrust of each other? Will they finally acknowledge the truth behind their snark, that they've actually loved each other all along? The cover on this one had me puzzling what it was, I've got to admit, until I realised it was a hockey puck flying through rainbow dust. Nicole Pyland's new novel, Reality Check, is also doing well in the US, and it's got an intriguing storyline. But first, of course, this one gets the award for Fabulous Character Nameage, and this month, Nicole's characters are Callie Banks and Dayton Maine. Dayton Maine, I mean, that is a fantastically American name, isn't it? So good job, Nicole. Callie is a hermit who goes on a reality show to raise money as she's just lost her job and moving back in with her parents. You know, it hasn't been great for Callie, and we can all understand that. Dayton is put on the reality show too, and she's a reality show mainstay who's employed to bring the drama and hook up with the other woman. They shouldn't be drawn together, and yet they are. Can the playgirl tame the hermit? Or should that be the other way around? Can the hermit tame the playgirl? Yes, one of those. If that sounds like your bag, snap it up now. Finally, also doing well in the US is Natasha West with her latest lesbian romance, Ride the Wave. This one is set on board a cruise ship, which is unfortunate timing, what with cruise ships being off limits with the coronavirus breakout. But let's imagine a corona-free world, if you will, where lesbians board cruise ships with not a care in the world in the hope of finding love. Are you there? Are you with me on the high seas? Good. So the first lesbian on board Natasha West's boat is Natalie Silver, who doesn't want to be there, but her sister's made her go. And guess who else is on board? Only Natalie's perfect bitch of a boss, Eden. So the pair circle each other warily, but being on a boat, there's nowhere to hide. Might they find out they have more in common than they thought? Images of the Love Boat spring to mind here, and I used to love that show. So, and Natasha's British humour and rom-coms are great. So get onto that one if you like the sound of that. Switching over to the UK, a couple of other new books have popped into my line of vision. Rough Around the Edges by Crystal Shard. Who needs fancy character names when your author name sounds like a side dish that a London restaurant might charge £18.95 for? Is the story of Roxy, who's having a shit time in London, and Josie, who has it all together. Hopeless meets stuffed shirt isn't an obvious recipe for love, but just add mojitos and anything is possible, right? So that one's called Rough Around the Edges by Crystal Shard. Last but not least, the lovely Max Ellendale, who was a guest on this podcast just a few episodes ago, and she was a fantastic interview. She has got her new book out, and it is called No Sare. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. This one is about introverted Rosie, who's held near and dear in the hearts of her friend in Mermaid Pod. However, she's having a difficult time accepting their love and support until she meets Samara. That is a late entry for great character nameage. Well done, Max. The bold and brazen anethiologist's direct attention turns Rosie's quiet world upside down. But their pasts are haunted and laden with harm, so can Rosie and Sam ache to find the light in a world they've grown to fear? Wow, that sounds like deep and something that you should get into. So that's the end of the chart roundup for April 2020, and what a month it's been. It hasn't been a normal month, has it? Has it been a year since we met, or just a month since we've met? I know, right? Looking back at the start of March, when I brought out the last lesbian book club, I'd just flown back from a week away, in Mallorca in the late February sunshine with friends to celebrate one of my friends' 40th birthdays. And back then, the world was as it normally is. We could go out, we could meet with our friends and family, we could go to restaurants, go to pubs, and I was looking forward to launching my latest novel, Before You Say I Do. And then the London Book Fair was cancelled, and then that was just the start of a domino effect of events cancelled due to the coronavirus, and then life itself being taken over and irrevocably altered by the unrelenting march. But, you know, it's just one of those things we're having to cope with, and I hope you're staying home. I am staying home for sure, and with all my friends and family doing the same as well. But it's been, you know, it's been nice finding new ways to connect, hasn't it? Reading a lot more books and also doing a lot more video chats, so a lot more Zooms and Skypes and house parties and all the rest of it. So this April, I hope you're well and that you and your friends and family are well too. And if you're not, I hope you get well soon. As I said, these are very strange, era-defining times. And you'd be forgiven for thinking we're living in the pages of a dystopian fiction novel, but we're not. The whole world is on lockdown, so it's time to hunker down. Read those books you've been promising to read. Get through your TBR pile. Watch all that TV. Do some PE with Joe Wicks and make some banana bread. I have. You know, it's kind of your civic duty. I also tried to make some bread this weekend and my yeast was out of date. And let me just say that if you have out of date yeast, it's not going to make your bread rise. To say my bread was like a brick would be not understating it. And I had to go out to the shop and buy a loaf of bread, which is a lot easier when you think about it, isn't it? So it's a reason shops sell bread. I did have a whole list of upcoming events to tell you about in the Lesfic calendar, but they've mainly been cancelled. I was going to appear at the South Coast Lesfic Hangout, God, I can't speak today, on May the 2nd, but that's no more. That's now moved to September the 12th, I believe. So if you want to put that date in your calendar, I won't be there because I can't make that weekend, but there's loads and loads of fantastic authors who are going to be there. So put September the 12th in the calendar, and hopefully by then, events will be back up and running. At the moment, I think Golden Crown Literary Society, or GCLS, in Albuquerque in July is still taking place, July the 8th to the 12th, but, you know, check it before you book it. The same goes for the Queer the Shells event at Waterstones, Nottingham, currently taking place on June the 5th. Again, check it before you book it. As for me, well, as I said, I launched Before You Say I Do, and it's, well, hands down been my most successful launch to date, which is absolutely awesome. And as I said, if you read it and reviewed it, thank you so much. I've been thinking about writing this one ever since I heard an interview with a professional bridesmaid on a radio interview about 18 months, 2 years ago. So it's been marinating in my head for quite a while. But I'm really, really, as I said, thrilled that it's gone down so well. Currently, I'm writing my next book. I've just finished the first draft, actually, which is a co-write with my friend and fellow author, T.B. Markinson. This one is set in Whitstable, and it's an age gap romance between a Whitstable local and a movie star. So expect oysters, brewing desire, sunshine, and no end of shingle beaches. All being well, this one should be out in June. In fact, TB was over in London from the US just before the coronavirus really took hold, and we actually had a weekend away in Whitstable, the second weekend in March, just before the country went into serious lockdown, so we were lucky to get that in, and it was great to be able to show TB around before she flew back to the States. In audiobook news, A Taste of Love is now out in audio, so if you're after another audiobook to read, that one is available. And it's read by Gabrielle Baker, who narrated my redemption novel, Nothing to Lose. So if you liked that, get on to A Taste of Love. That's about all my news, because other than launching or writing, I haven't been doing much apart from staying at home, going out for the occasional walk and trying to flatten the curve, or probably fatten some curves, because let's face it, we're all eating and drinking far more staying at home, aren't we, and not moving as much. That is a small price to pay to get the world back to where we were, and hopefully a kinder, better world on the other side. Anyway, stay safe, stay sane, stay home, and now let's get on with the interview with the wonderful Karen Callmaker. Joining me today is US author Karen Callmaker. Wikipedia tells me she's dubbed the queen of lesbian romance, so she doesn't need much introduction. Karen has written over 30 novels, countless novellas and short stories, her latest being Because I Said So, which I loved and read for this interview. She's a California native and lives with her partner near San Francisco, so welcome, Karen.
It's great to be here.
It's lovely to have you. As I said, you are the queen of lesbian romance, so I do feel I feel in the presence of royalty.
The first time I saw that phrase, it was on the back of a book. I mean, I literally had just gotten the book, opened the box. Oh, look, it's a pretty cover. Yay. And turned it over, and that phrase was on the back. And it's just like, where did that come from? Okay, well, I'll accept it. Thank you for the honor. I'm a femme. You know, I've never turned down a tiara. So.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you have a crown or anything? You do.
Yep. Good. Yeah, I do. I rock it quite well.
And you wear it daily, walking around the Bay Area?
No, they're very insulated to that kind of glamour here. You know, celebrities come to San Francisco and they get ignored because that's sort of an ethos of the place. We let LA does their thing with celebrities. Mm-hmm. We do. We give them space.
Okay.
We're respectful. Yeah. Cool.
So I should mention that we are recording this on St. Patrick's Day, so happy St. Patrick's Day, and also it's just that the very beginning of the coronavirus pandemic that's starting. Any plans to write an infection stroke invasion story into a romance novel anytime soon?
Only in retrospect. I kind of like to know how things turn out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, people have been asking me that, and I think I'm like, no, I have no plans, but never say never, right? Yeah.
I think it's inevitable that we'll write stories that reflect that it existed and that it happened, but I don't plan to write about it.
No. So tell me a little bit about what you can see from where you're sitting today.
Where I am?
Yep.
Well, I am in my office, which for the first time, we're empty nesters, my wife and I, so for the first time, I have an office to myself, the proverbial room of my own.
Yeah.
that Virginia Woolf told us all we should have. So I'm pretty comfortable. And this is nice. I'm, you know, surrounded by the things that I like to look at when I'm writing.
What do you like to look at when you're writing?
Let's see. I have this awesome poster of Wonder Woman, comic book based Wonder Woman, on the back of my door. She's just short of life sized. So when I'm procrastinating, you know, maybe scrolling social media when I ought to be writing, I look over and she's giving me this stern look of, what are you doing and why are you not writing? But if I swivel this direction, I don't have to see her. Uh-huh. And then I can just look at my Deadpool figurines.
Okay. I love that you've got a life-size Wonder Woman on the back of your door. So that was a great nugget of information there. I love that you're inspired by Wonder Woman. Maybe you should get a matching one of Gal Gadot as well, because she's also inspirational.
Well, yeah, she's pretty wonderful.
Tell us a bit about your writing journey, Karen, and how you got started.
Like a lot of writers, I just started writing when I was, you know, they gave me a pencil and said, here, write between these lines, and I started writing. And I loved reading since forever. They couldn't take books out of my hands. I would talk nonstop while reading. I don't do that anymore because people on, like, the bus get nervous when you do that. I read, I write. I loved creative writing assignments. When other kids were groaning, I was just like, oh, sure. Yeah. I'll write a diary about crossing the West.
Yeah.
And it just scrawl stories, and I loved it, and read tons of, in my teens, I read a lot of Harlequin romances, which I loved, really got into the sort of the rhythm of those stories, which they get a bad rap, you know, Harlequin and Mills and Boons, and that they're patriarchal and stereotyped. Mm-hmm. And I found them, you know, oh, look, there's all these women in these stories and they're independent. And yeah, sure, there's some guy, he comes along, whatever. But it was very often about their search for a place in the world and how they kind of controlled their life and tried to make that happen. So I always took that as being sort of subversive, the whole idea that women were in control of their lives. So I loved romance and stuck with that. But it wasn't until I read Curious Wine in my mid-20s where I even realized you could write a story about two women. Mm. Who knew?
Yeah.
It was a revelation. So I read that and thought, okay, so I'll stop trying to write that other kind of romance and focus on a romance with two women. It could actually get published and turn into a book, although that was just a pipe dream. But so I wrote my first lesbian focused romance and set off to Naiad Press, and they accepted it. It was a minor miracle. And so after that, there was no looking back. I haven't had to pitch a book with any real uncertainty that it'd be picked up for most of my writing career.
Wow.
Which is,
yeah.
I feel like I'm that bitch. I'm sorry. It just kind of worked out that way.
I think the lesbian reading and writing world will forgive you. But that is quite amazing, because they always say that writers face a lot of rejection throughout their career. So, yeah, it's a lovely position to be in.
Oh, definitely. And it was an amazing time, too. You had publishers who were absolutely looking for what we were doing, and they had 1,000 bookstores to sell your books to. So there was this great economy that women built for themselves because the doors were all closed in the rest of the publishing world. So
yeah,
I got really lucky.
It might have been a bit of luck, but also your talent shone through as well, one might say. And have you jumped around different presses during your career?
No, I published with Naiad until the two women who ran it, that was Barbara Greer and Donna McBride, until they retired in 2003. So that was 14 years with them. And they encouraged their authors to sign contracts over at Bella Books, which is what I did. Mm-hmm. And I'm still publishing with Bella.
Right. Okay, cool. So how would you describe one of your books to someone who's never read one?
First, it's always going to be a romance, but I got to admit, no two are really alike. So if you, they fall into clusters. When you write enough, you start to have to group things. So there are shorter stories that are more like dessert, and then there are some real meat and potato stories. But they're all romance. The women get to be the heroes in whatever way they are in their own lives, and you get a happy ending, which matters more than anything to me. I love happy endings.
I'm with you on that totally. If it's not a HEA, I'm not interested. I'm like that with movies as well. It's like, do you want to come and watch this thriller, Claire? No. Is it a rom-com? No, I'm not interested.
Yeah, thrillers are dicey. I like mysteries. I read mysteries and I watch mysteries because you always get justice at the end. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, romance novels are like getting a kind of interpersonal justice between the two people at the end of the story, so that there's that lovely catharsis and this sense that everything's right with the world. So I love mysteries for that.
Cool. And I like that description of romance justice. I like that. So I read, because I said so for this podcast, it's my first ever book by you, which a few people were amazed at.
There are plenty of people who've never read me yet. That's just the way it is.
But isn't that great, you see, because I will be reading more of you now. So it's always lovely to know that, you know, that you've got this fantastic back catalogue for me to read through. It's very exciting. But I love the story of two women who fell for each other after they got wrenched apart and meet again 4 years later. And I thought the storytelling was as stylish as the clothes its lead protagonist made. Tell me a little bit about writing it, and also how much research you had to do into dressmaking, because it seemed very detailed.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I was inspired to write it because here in California, we have a really mixed population. And the third most spoken language in California is Tagalog. So I wanted to write this story because I wanted a California story, quintessentially Californian. And you can't, or you shouldn't, really write a story that doesn't reflect that the world is just a mixed bag here, all sorts of people from all sorts of places. But we have so many Filipinos moving into the United States, and they have been for a generation. I really just wanted to look at Filipino Americans and what their life is like when they arrive in California, and especially that second generation trying to make their way in this odd state that we have. So that's where Kisa Sapiro came from. And then her foil, Shannon, is somebody who also lived a sort of a unique Los Angeles life, which is very mixed. Your neighbors are different people. There are bubbles all over California where everybody looks like everybody else in that little bubble. But for the most part, we're all rubbing shoulders with different cultures. So I wanted to celebrate that at the heart of the story. But it was mostly about the twist of it's a second chance romance, but you don't know that until you're a good piece into the book that the two people had even met. So I also wanted to write about that twist. So there are a lot of little things, you know, coming together to make me want to write and tell this particular story. But the dressmaking wasn't, I still don't know much about dressmaking, but my philosophy is that the reader only has to believe that the character is an expert. They don't have to believe that I am. So I did one of my usual tricks of looking for little pieces of dressmaking that are very specific to it, and then using them in very minor places so that the character comes off as this casual authority. So like one example of that, I think, is I looked up when you draw a pattern for a dress, what kind of supplies does that take? And so I quickly found the desirable paper that you draw on and the kinds of pencils that you use. And so I just had the character refer to them very casually. And I think that little touches like that make the reader really feel like the character is an expert at their field. But I couldn't tell you now what those pencils are.
I won't ask you then. I'll be nice. No, it really did come across, and I guess that's a top tip for anybody listening who is writing. Just get the little details and drop them in. You don't have to have this massive backstory on any subject.
Unless you really love it. Yeah. You want to deep dive. But that can sometimes, you know, get in the way of the story.
Yeah.
I research to death. I mean, I will learn all sorts of things that never end up in the book just because I love it. But I've learned a little goes a really long way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also love the family dynamic in this one with the two leads having younger siblings or younger people to look out for. And I know you, as you said, have two adult children. So did you draw on experience to write this book? Have they recognized themselves in it?
So far, my son doesn't have really any interest in reading them, so I don't have to worry about that. I can misrepresent him all I want. My daughter will eventually read it, and she's read several of my books, and we don't talk about that, especially those that are, as she got older, she started to read other of my titles that are a little more grown up, and I was like, okay, you can read them. I don't want to talk about it. So we have that agreement. We keep that, and one day a friend of hers did actually say, oh my God, Karen Kallmaker's your mother. And I thought, okay, this is different. Hadn't really seen that one coming. I hope that I kind of understand where young people are coming from today, in today's world. They've got all sorts of problems and issues that they're confronting that we didn't have to, and some of them we made for them. So I try to keep that in mind when I write younger characters. But these two don't reflect my kids that much. If you really wanted to see where my kids are, it's in a book called Roller Coaster. There's a set of twins. My kids aren't twins, but there's a set of twins, and yeah, that's my kids.
Okay.
I just stole from them.
Yeah, stole little bits. And as you kind of touched on writing sex scenes there, I did think the sex scenes in this book were just really gorgeous, very beautifully written with a real deft touch. So have you got any tips for writing great sex scenes, and have yours changed over the years?
I think they've changed over the years. Certainly when I first started writing, I was reading what was available. And in the 1980s, I don't know if you've heard of the lesbian sex wars, but there was a concerted movement to, you know, censor is the right word, to censor the kind of lesbian sexuality that was being put on the page, because some women felt that certain acts were reflective of patriarchal repression of women, mm-hmm. and other women felt that felt good, and it was all consensual, so what was the big deal? And this raged across college campuses in particular as a debate where women, lesbians especially, were boycotting other lesbians, and there was this big brouhaha about it. Dorothy Allison being one of my sheroes, she was definitely on the side of, if it's consensual and this is the way life is, then we shouldn't be censoring anything.
Yeah.
It's just the way the world is.
Yeah.
But it still, I think, had an influence on the kind of sensuality that was put on the page for a good chunk of the 80s. And that's what I read initially. So my first half dozen books, I was informed by what was okay by what I read, which is the insidious way that censorship works. And then over time, I kind of realized that I didn't have to restrict myself. And it wasn't like my publisher ever said, oh, don't do that, oh, don't do that. They would only say, we know this sells, and we know that if you head this direction, you'll please more readers. And they were really good about giving that kind of feedback without saying, you must do it this way, or you have to, you can't put that in a book. Mm-hmm. I never got that message from my publishers. So I think they've definitely changed over time in that sense, but I've always been much more of a sensualist. I like sex scenes that move through the emotion of what's happening and not necessarily the actual physical acts, unless they in some way further the plot. Like the first time somebody does a specific thing or consents in some way that they haven't to in the past, that those things can make the scene so much more intense than focus on, you know, whose finger might be touching what piece of skin. You want a little of that, at least for me. Because if I want to write or read erotica, then the actual physical, the physicality of it is super important. But I still like the emotional through point of the plot to be carrying some of the story at the same time. Because a good sex scene does more than one thing. And the plot is, of course, every scene has to serve the plot.
Absolutely. And I love that you called yourself a sensualist, because I think that does actually describe it. So, I might strive to be a sensualist going forward. Oh, more of one anyway. And you talked about sheroes there. You mentioned Dorothy Allison. You've also worked with Catherine V. Forrest as your editor, who is and should be a shero in the whole lesbian romance world.
Oh, yeah.
Because she wrote Curious Wine, which is a lesbian fiction classic. And I read this week that it sold over 100,000 copies, which is absolutely amazing, but not surprising.
Not surprising.
No. I remember when I read that, it was only like about 5 years ago, and I was just stunned. It's such a great book, still holds up. But you wrote Painted Moon, which was hailed as the next Curious Wine. So what did you think when you heard that?
That it was a nice phrase of marketing, but how on earth could I produce anything that would be of the quality of Curious Wine? Because that's what Curious Wine was, so incredibly well written. And it said, yes, the stories of women's lives can be the centerpiece of a novel, and it can have a happy ending and deserves to have one, but it can also be extremely well written and have an elevated approach to the story. So I wouldn't call it literary, but Catherine's skill with words is of that quality. And so it blew me away, and I did not think that anything I could write would ever come close. So I just thought, well, that sounds all nice and pretty, but NIAID is, you know, they're eager to sell books.
Their marketing department's brilliant.
I thought that was brilliant. I think that may be the same book where it said the undisputed mistress of lesbian romance, or it was that book or the next one.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, it's all marketing. Don't let it go to your head. I still feel like I'm trying to write anything nearly as good as Curious Wine.
And how was it having her as your editor, then?
She's quite possibly the most gifted editor I've ever worked with or seen working with other people. It's hard to describe. To get a four-page letter that breaks down your novel succinctly and carefully, it proves, you know, that she read it and then stepped back and did that concept level edit, you know, where these things make sense and this is what you did well, and I don't understand why you even brought this into it if you didn't finish it. And it's just this really amazing amazing take on my work, and I owe her such a I owe her an incredible debt of gratitude because she edited my first book, which was unbelievable. I mean, I would just look at her words and break out in a cold sweat. She got my second novel and had major issues with it. It had big flaws, but she loved the essence of the story. So she told Barbara to take it off the schedule so that I could rewrite it. Otherwise, if they published it, I probably, you know, it would do okay, but not many people would be back for my third book because it was flawed. And Barbara agreed. So they gave me, you know, they took it off the schedule and moved it 8 months down and gave me that chance to rewrite it with Catherine's guidance. And I am convinced that that's why I'm still writing books 30 years later.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And did she carry on being your editor as well? Like, did she edit Painted Moon?
No, that was edited by Christy Cassidy, who took over a lot of the editing jobs at NIAID when Catherine, she left editing for NIAID to publish with Berkeley Crime. And so she was escalating her Catherine B. Forrest output. Okay. So she stepped away from editing. So a lot of my books in my early career were all edited by Christy Cassidy, who is also an excellent editor, right. Especially on the copy editing side. I still don't know where the commas go. Yay, what can I say?
Yeah.
they changed the rules. That's all I can. They changed the rules, and I still don't know. Didn't know then, and I don't know now.
I was going to say, does anybody really know where the commas go? You know, it's a moving target.
It really is. I figure if I read it aloud and I pause to breathe there, that's where the comma goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. So obviously Painted Moon is one of yours that everybody talks about and lauds. It's probably, would you say it's like one of the key favorite ones of your novels?
It's definitely my best-selling novel of, if you go back over everything.
Yeah.
It followed closely by Wild Things, which was, I think, the book that came right after it.
So why do you think that some books click more than others? Do you have a theory? Did you have a feeling when you wrote either of those?
Not at all. I never predict well my own book's success. And I spent several years as Bella's editorial director, and I was only right about half the time as to what would really, you know, grab and which authors would do a second and a third book to shore up their hold on an audience. I still don't know. I think timing and luck are a huge part of it, because if they weren't, then I know so many excellent writers who never quite found their niche. They never quite clicked. Their stories are excellent, and I can't explain why they didn't find an audience. And I think timing and luck is a huge part of it, like it is in the performing arts. Mm-hmm. Why two very similar actors, one reaches pinnacles and the other, you know, gets work, but just isn't quite as famous. And I think luck is a huge, huge part of it. You have to have the talent, you have to have the work ethic, but then timing and luck come into it.
So are you a full-time writer?
Yes, as in I'm not doing anything else for money. Full-time isn't quite descriptive in that my wife retired several years ago, so we've done a lot of traveling, kind of making up for lost time, as she worked for a very large bank for decades. So now we're kind of in this sweet spot of being able to travel and go where we like. But when I'm home, yeah, I'm if I'm not actively writing a manuscript, I'm thinking about it and doing research and just trying to. My process is very scattered. It should be more methodical, but I get an idea and I chew on it for a while, and I might have multiple ideas and I'll dash off. Oh, if I wanted to follow that idea, I'll write this scene, and so I'll just write mostly the dialogue of a scene and set it aside, and come back to it and discover it again later when I'm actually like it. I don't formally outline, but I do start thinking about, okay, these are the things that happen in the story, this is the order they happen in, and I'll find these scraps about it that I've been writing for, you know, 4 or 5 months. Mm-hmm. And then I start stitching it together, kind of like making a dress.
So you don't have like word counts during the day or anything like that? It's just more of a something that you sort of noodle around.
I noodle, and then the deadline gets closer and I start putting myself on a more regimented, okay, so today if I want to make my week, I set myself a weekly goal of wanting to move the story along. I could edit a book for the rest of my life if I wanted. I could just keep tweaking. At some point, a deadline's a really good thing because you got to let it go.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you have a favorite thing about writing?
My favorite thing about writing is writing, and that's my least favorite thing.
Succinct answer there. Why is that, would you say?
I think it can be, it's incredible. When you hit a groove, I'm sure this has happened to you. Mm-hmm. You hit a groove, and it is like this magic is happening. You're a wizard. It's all just wonderful, and the words just flow, and you're in the zone, and the characters are talking to you, and everything is wonderful. And that feeling is the endorphins that I don't get. You know, people talk about endorphins for exercise. I never get them, but I can get them while I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And when you have to write and you don't have that magic going on, that's really hard. That's when it feels like it's a grind and partly a curse that you have to attempt it when, for whatever reason, the magic's not happening.
Yeah, that's when it's like walking through sludge. But, you know, you always find that the words you write and when you come back to them, they're never as bad as you think, are they?
No, they're not. I'll go back and go, well, actually, that turned out okay.
Yeah.
And I feel a little sparkly today, so I'll make that a little sparklier.
Yeah.
And voila, it all comes out. It works out in the end. But the slog times, boy, they're hard.
And how many books are you producing now per year? Is there one a year or more than that?
About one a year, and occasionally there'll be a novella idea that'll come to me where I really just think that's a great story, but it's not a novel length story. It's not, whatever that thread is won't stretch out that long. Mm-hmm. Without major change of concept or addition of characters or something. If I feel like I can write that quickly, I'll just do it.
Okay, cool. And are you an avid reader of Lesbic?
I used to be. Avid's the wrong word. I read it, but I read so many submissions with Bella that I burned out. Mm. And, I'm burned out's kind of the wrong word. I have red pencil syndrome, and I cannot put that red pencil down in my head. So it's really hard for me to step back and lose myself in a story without, you know, going, oh, well, that, where did that come from? Or a point of view break. And so it gets in the way a lot. So I'm hoping it comes back because I miss the stories. Mm. I want to be back into enjoying, especially romance. But I read lesbian mysteries. I read a lot of mysteries because I can't write one. I tried and it was abysmal, so I don't do that anymore. Yeah. So I read them because a lot of me just says, oh, I can't do this. So the judging goes away and the red pencil stays, you know, sitting on my ear.
And what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given?
It definitely came from Catherine Forrest, and I think it's extremely useful, which is that a book can only be as good as you can make it at the time. It can't be better than that, and so it's really important to know that it is as good as you can make it. So whatever mistakes or offense you may give in the book, you can at least honestly say it was the best you could do. You didn't know better, but now you do. It's to have that integrity, at least, that you are doing the very best you can. It doesn't have to be perfect because you're not perfect yet. And you know, I still make mistakes in my work. I still have flaws in the way I build characters. I'm still very much a cisgender white girl who grew up in the Midwest of California. So I make mistakes with characters and with representation, but I'm, you know, doing the best I can. I can say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're aware of everything and your background and where you're coming at it from, and that's the best you can do. That's the best we can all do. If someone's coming fresh to your books, Karen, which one should they pick up first and why?
Gosh, that's always a hard question, and I approach it kind of as a librarian, like who else do you read, and what other books are, and then I can kind of hone in and say, okay, so this is more your speed, because I can give you the super angsty, you know, crying for days kind of story, and I can give you a nice, you know, cupcake of a lovely dessert feel, all happy, feel good. So within that range, I'd always direct somebody to probably Painted Moon or Wild Things. And of my more recent books, I'm always fond of the last one I wrote. So I like Because I Said So for a lot of reasons. My Lady Lipstick is an awful lot of fun.
And I love the title for that one, My Lady Lipstick. And I can second because I Said So. I really did enjoy it. So yeah, go read that one. So what are your publishing plans for this year?
I am working on frantically, and I need to finish the last two chapters because my deadline might be on the calendar at a date that's behind me. And it's called Simply the Best. And if you're familiar with the movie Born Yesterday, 1940s, 50s kind of classic screwball comedy, and The Devil Wears Prada, I'm kind of inspired by both of those in creating this sort of triangle of characters with an ingenue and a snippy know-it-all reporter and a business tycoon, moving those three people around. It's very obvious from the beginning that the reporter and the ingenue are your two lead characters, but that business tycoon makes the story very, very interesting. So I have to get it finished, and yeah, my publisher really, really wants me to get it finished.
And so is that going to be coming out in 2020, or are you just getting it done for 2020?
It should be coming out, I'm crossing my fingers, at the Gold Crown Conference in July, all crossing our fingers that we will be having it.
Yeah.
And it's, the conference is in Albuquerque, and the book is set in Albuquerque, so.
Oh, okay.
That's, I really, really like that. That would be great.
That would be good. Anything with Devil Wears Prada, nod to it, should do very well, I think. And if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
I would probably pick Jane Austen, who is the mother of us all in romance, largely for the idea that she wrote her books in two drafts. That just boggles my mind. But then she was writing one sentence at a time and making each sentence perfect as she went. So there's Jane Austen, and then there's Jane Rule, I think, who told such fearless stories about women who loved women within the context of literary storytelling. And that's where you get, you know, Desert of the Heart, which became the movie Desert Hearts.
Yeah.
Memory Board, which is another just incredible story about an older lesbian couple dealing with Alzheimer's and the changes of the nature of their relationship. It's just, it sounds depressing, but it's incredibly moving and incredibly uplifting. So I'd probably, those two, they made words so delicious that it inspires me.
Yeah, I love that pairing, actually, and I must read Memory Board because I did love Desert of the Heart, and I've heard Jane Rule interviewed, and she sounded amazing.
She was amazing. So we've all been so lucky by the women that we get to follow.
Absolutely, totally agree. And a little fun question before I ask you where readers can find more about you: do you have a signature dish?
Oh golly. I make the most incredible oatmeal cookies. They're amazing. dark chocolate and cherry.
Ah, that sounds...
a chewy oatmeal cookie. And the recipe's on my website.
Oh, there you go. So if you want to make Karen Coolmaker's oatmeal cookies, go to her website, which is karencoolmaker.com.
It's just coolmaker.com.
Coolmaker.com. So that's what was my final question. Where can readers find out more about you and your oatmeal cookies?
my website's really detailed, and anybody who's wondering if a story would be what they're looking for, there's an excerpt from every single book on my website. A lot of what's there is to help me remember. So there's massive amount of details about all the books, you know, when they were published and if they had another cover, because you might have read it before. You can check the art and go, oh, I remember that, and then you don't have to buy it again, which would be good. So my website has everything about my books and short stories and the things I choose to blog about, like my favorite oatmeal recipe things. And I'm also kind of, I like internet security issues because I think we should all be safe out there. So I have articles about that sort of thing too. It's sort of an odd mix, but.
Okay. So biscuit recipes and internet security and books all in one. Go to coolmaker.com. Well, Karen, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. And I hope things, settle down all over the world and especially in the Bay Area where you are.
Oh, well, thank you, and you too. I hope that your leadership, finally sort of steps up.
Wow.
And we can all feel just a little safer.
Yes.
And but the I think the real key there is just be kind to each other, look out for each other, and we'll get through it.
Yes. Okay. Stay safe. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you, Claire.
That's the end of this lesbian book club. So this is me, your host, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy digging into any of my books, the London series, the All I Want series, or any of my standalones, including my latest lesbian romance novel, Before You Say I Do, you can find them at my website direct, which is www.clairelydon.co.uk, or wherever good books are sold. That is Amazon Kindle, Apple Books, Google Play, Kobo, Bella Books, Ilva Publishing, and frankly, all over the web. My audiobooks are also mainly Wide, so look on all those sites for those too. Thanks so much to Denise at the Lesbian Lounge for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And join me next time when I'm going to be interviewing the wonderful Anna Burke. See you then.